I face every element there is. Even winter, I will walk and walk and walk, and nothing can stop me.
That's Keanu, walking to a friend's house with our producer Matthew, who met her on a bus. Keanu says that walking in Kansas City can have its challenges.
I don't like coming at this end too often because the neighborhood to me further down is kind of not so good.
Sometimes those challenges are with infrastructure.
There's no crosswalk or light. It's kind of like Bolton, like you gotta take your risk.
How many lanes of traffic are we about to cross?
Two.
You tell me when.
Okay.
I'll follow your lead.
Go.
Here we go.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard is all about walking for transportation. Does Kansas City have a pedestrian culture? Are you a part of it? Call us up and share your stories. We want to know what works and what doesn't for pedestrians here in town. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. Later in the show, we'll be talking about the Royals, those supposed bad boys of baseball. For now, let's stick with walking. Here in the studio, I'm joined by Beau Williams. He specializes in long-range planning and preservation for the city's Planning and Development Office. Hi, Beau.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Thank you.
We're also joined by Daniel Serta. He's Central Standard's urban design expert, and he's with us from the firm Insight. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me again.
It's also my pleasure to introduce a walker. Rhianna Weiler doesn't just walk in Kansas City. She blogs about walking in Kansas City. Her blog is called The Pedestrian Path. Hi, Rhianna.
Hi.
So how are you doing today? Tell me about your transportation situation.
Actually, about a year ago, my car was totaled by a hit and run. And my husband had actually given up his car about a year or two before because he didn't ever use it. We were literally jump-starting it when we needed it because it would just sit.
Why weren't you using your car?
We actually,
or why wasn't he using his car, I guess?
He lives, or he works really close to where he lives, so he was walking, and really we had become so stressed with driving that we just opted to walk more and more.
So do you walk everywhere now?
Walking and bus, and sometimes biking.
So what are some of the first things you noticed about the pedestrian experience in Kansas City when you started walking?
I think there's little things you pick up on that become frustrating over time that maybe you wouldn't notice from a car. So things getting left on the sidewalk, overgrown brush. Like construction equipment is a big ordeal right now with the streetcar going in. There's a lot of just equipment being left or sidewalks being blocked. So you literally have to, like, you know, I call it obstacle courses sometimes because you're running and snaking between them. And after a while, like if you're walking every single day and that's your path, it's kind of like potholes, you know. They become frustrating when you see it day after day and you're constantly dodging them.
To dodge them, do you have to go into the street with car traffic?
Sometimes, yeah, yeah.
Eek. Well, in the little walk that our producer Matthew took with a different Kansas City pedestrian earlier in the show, safety came up in a number of ways, from the sense of safety you might feel walking alone in certain areas to safety while, like, bolting across several lanes of car traffic. Talk to me about safety.
Yeah, I always try to get more people walking because literally, the more people that are out walking, the more safe you're going to feel. The more eyes are on the road. And when people are driving, they're generally focused on driving or where they're going. So the more pedestrians that are out, the more safe you're going to feel. Also, just like safety in terms of what the drivers are doing. I always say, like, just be suspicious of all cars and don't trust what you think they're going to do. And try and make eye contact because there's a lot of drivers who are still using their cell phone when they're going around and not paying attention.
So the eye contact gives you that security that you've been seen.
Yes.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Are there any little changes that could be made to improve your experience as a pedestrian?
Like the construction zones, I think a lot of cities generally require that construction provides a barrier for pedestrians to go around the construction, and that may encroach into the street, but right now that's not really a requirement, and it doesn't happen that often. So providing like barriers would be really helpful.
Are there any other like infrastructural things that would help you? Are there places where there's an amenity that could be lacking, or anything other than sidewalk obstacles?
I mean, sometimes there's literally not a sidewalk. Sometimes there's like weeds that are overgrown, and it's just a matter of getting a MoDOT to come and clear the brush that's around the highway where the sidewalks are. It's just little things that are really easy to take care of, but they just kind of get left unseen because people are generally driving by and they're not noticing them.
When you walk at night, do you have streetlights everywhere you need them to be walking out of darkness?
Generally, yes, and that's kind of an ongoing issue. I live by I-35, so anytime that I'm walking under I-35, it gets pretty dark, and the city just installed lights on 17th under the bridge, which has been a huge help. It makes the area feel so much more safe, and hopefully that gets continued further down under I-35 around Southwest Boulevard, 20th Street, that area.
How would you assess the city's overall walkability right now in 2015? What's your report from the streets?
I think that the closer you get to downtown, the easier it is, definitely. And I think that it's getting better as the years go by, for sure.
Daniel Serta, how would you assess the city's overall walkability?
Oh, it varies tremendously depending on where you are. Most people you ask, if you ask them, you know, what parts of Kansas City are walkable, they'll tell you a couple of things. One is they'll tell you downtown. And the other place that people will always mention is the Country Club Plaza. And what's interesting there is downtown, I think, has its share of challenges. And I know a number of people that are very concerned about a lot of the fine, messy details about what makes downtown walkable or not. But the plaza really, to me, in a lot of respects, should be the standard bearer in Kansas City because it was designed from the time that it was originally developed to be an eminently walkable place. Walkability was one of the key ideas that J.C. Nichols had in mind when he created the plaza. I often tell people that the physical design of the sidewalks, the pedestrian crossings in the street and the plaza is much more important to the experience of the plaza, this place, than the architecture is.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, what I mean by that is obviously the plaza has this imprint of various Spanish styles, right? I mean, there are buildings down there that are direct replicas of buildings in Seville, Spain, a place that J.C. Nichols was very enamored with. That creates a certain level of aesthetic character for the plaza. But I think what really creates the experience in the plaza is the fact that there are very deep sidewalks. There are what planners would call deep setbacks of buildings from the street. You can walk three or four abreast comfortably on the Country Club Plaza. There are places in downtown Kansas City where you can barely walk single file because of whether it's planter boxes or street signs or poles or just the fact that the sidewalk is very narrow. It's more of a challenge. There's also the really important urban design dimension for walkability anywhere that most of us are subconsciously aware of, not always consciously aware of, is the diversity of activities and uses along the street that you're walking in. And that's one of the things that factors into the walkability of downtown. There are a lot of parts of downtown where there are protected pedestrian crossings and there are wide sidewalks. But if there aren't interesting businesses and places and you're walking past empty parking lots or vacant buildings, it creates a certain level of almost psychological discomfort about where you're walking, and the places are a little less attractive to be as a pedestrian.
It sounds like this is something that maybe Rihanna has dealt with.
Oh, definitely. I'm constantly trying to come up with ideas on how to fill in these empty blocks that surround us in my neighborhood, and I think there's little
and
things...
And what neighborhood is that, just to be really clear?
West Side.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think there's little things that maybe it seems fine. Maybe it's not. Maybe the grass is cut. But like in the summer, if there's nothing in that lot, then it creates no shade and it becomes hostile to walk because of the heat.
So, Bo Williams from the city, you're listening to these people talk about what it's like to walk in our city, and we're hearing some pretty specific critiques of that situation. I wonder what you can say about some of these things we've heard about.
Well, I would agree with Daniel that it's highly variable depending on where you are in our city as to how walkable those areas are. Our urban core tends to be our most walkable area, and that includes the plaza and downtown, as we've already discussed. But we have a lot of other suburban and even rural areas within Kansas City, Missouri, that may not have that same level or an acceptable, if you will, level of walkable character. Particularly those that were built, say, before they were within the city, they were annexed after they were constructed into the city, and they may not have been originally built to what we call urban standards, say, lack sidewalks and other basic pedestrian infrastructure. And we see a lot of those neighborhoods where there's a high need for pedestrian mobility and a complete absence or almost complete absence of the pedestrian infrastructure to facilitate that movement.
So what's being done about that? Is something being done about it?
We did do our Kansas City Walkability Plan back in 2003, which highlighted that particular issue. And what it does is what I just stated. It identifies those areas where there's a high need or a high demand for pedestrian mobility without any of the pedestrian infrastructure in place. And those first-ring suburbs are one of the places that really popped out on the map, so to speak.
And by first-ring suburbs, we mean what? What are some examples of first-ring suburbs?
Those that were typically developed shortly after World War II. They were sort of our first auto-oriented ring of suburbs around the city. So some examples would be the areas around the sports complex or south of 85th Street in South Kansas City, those kinds of areas.
So those would be the most challenging for residents then according to your plan?
Yeah, by our analysis, there's a lot of demand in those areas for people to be able to walk. And those areas, unfortunately, often lack the basic infrastructure to facilitate that movement.
So does the plan include a solution to that problem?
Yeah, so one of the more important things the plan does is identifies how to prioritize how we spend our very limited resources at the city. And it does so by identifying those areas that are the most important to spend our money for pedestrian infrastructure. And so the plan makes a policy recommendation that the city begin to target their capital improvement funding for pedestrian infrastructure into those high need areas like we just talked about.
Daniel, just thinking about cities in general, what does pedestrian culture and a vibrant pedestrian culture do for a city or a neighborhood? Is the presence of people out walking an important part of city life?
Absolutely. But it's also part of a sort of symbiotic relationship between people and the environment that they're in. The National Trust for Historic Preservation did a study about a year ago, and they looked at three cities, I think it was Philadelphia, New York, and Washington, and they looked at neighborhood business districts within each of those. And what they found was the areas that were the most walkable tend to have a fairly large stock of older, smaller buildings. You're looking at areas where a single block might have six or eight buildings on it, each of them fairly narrow, each of them containing small-scale businesses and that sort of thing. So the areas where there tended to be more walking, there tended to be more economic activity. There tended to be a wider range of businesses. And the reason I say that's a symbiotic relationship is because walking is really incumbent upon having interesting places to go and destinations to reach. And the most comfortable environments in which to walk, as Rihanna suggested earlier, are those where there are other people around, and other people are going to be around where there are other businesses and activities going on. So generally speaking, the places that are the most walkable tend to have a certain level of economic vitality to them as well, and their economic vitality in turn is shaped by the fact that they're so approachable and they're such comfortable places for people to be in, and they're so easily accessible, especially by pedestrians.
Is that why when people go to, people from Kansas City who live here and in many cases don't walk much, go to someplace like New York on vacation, walk everywhere without giving it a second thought, and then here at home, it's like it's some crazy fringe behavior.
Absolutely. There's a lot, as Bo suggested, there's a lot of our physical environment, particularly areas that were developed after World War II, where the scale of the homes and the size of the yards and the lack of sidewalks, for example, really just in very subtle ways absolutely discourage you from walking, and people become a little bit complacent about that. And again, what makes a place interesting to visit and an interesting place to be is the presence of other people, the presence of a lot of diverse activities, and an experience on the street. And that's really, I mean, you think of any vital city, what you're really thinking about is the presence of people on the streets. That's, I think, no matter where you're talking about, whether you're talking about New York, London, Singapore, L.A., you know, I was in L.A. a week and a half ago, and we spent an entire afternoon in Santa Monica and the Third Street Promenade. There, it's just teeming with people. Why? Because it's a pedestrian mall. That's not just a, you know, a closed street for pedestrians. The weather absolutely helps. Weather is a huge factor as well, as are safety considerations and the infrastructure considerations we mentioned already. But you know what really makes that place buzz is the fact that there are so many really interesting, varied businesses, you know, restaurants,
and close together.
And they're close together. And it's absolutely a people magnet. You know, I mean, the ocean's right there too, right? But, you know, you're talking an area that's three blocks off of Ocean Drive, and it's right not on the beachfront. It's a little ways away, and you have reasons to be there. You have, it's, there's whole, the experience of place is what really draws people to that kind of setting.
Let's hear from some of our callers. We've got John in Old Shawnee. Welcome to the show, John.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I am fine. I walk everywhere. I chose a few years back to do without a car, and I love it. It is a challenge at times. Distances, we have a very, very limited bus system in Johnson County, and that's a hard thing, but you just have to work around it. And then, two, but I love it. I just love it.
What do you love about it?
It just opens up your mind, and you know, when you're walking, you're getting good exercise, and you notice things that you've never noticed before. Houses, scenic views, trees that you've walked by or lived by all your life, you notice them. You're like, wow, I've never noticed that before.
You're slowed down enough to see these things.
Yeah, you look at things in a different perspective, and I've become a lot more more creative. It's like it opens up your more creative side, and I've become more kind of like a hippie on the inside. I've just become more open to a lot of things. And at nighttime, of course, I'm a guy. At nighttime, you know, you see the stars and you see shooting stars, and you're like, wow, I've never seen those things. And if you're you gain more of an appreciation for what surrounds you.
So walking has created an inner hippie and let it out a little bit. But have you noticed? Do you have any roadblock? Is there any obstacle that you'd like to raise, or are you just feeling the love?
Both. Now in Shawnee, one thing I've noticed, what I think is kind of funny, is kind of interesting, is they think you have a DUI if you walk everywhere. And they think,
you mean your neighbors think that?
Well, a lot of the people that see you walking, I've had a few remarks. Now, I've had a lot of positive remarks, but I've had some negative remarks. Or just not really mean, but just kind of question you, you know. People out here, they don't seem to walk a lot on the street. You do run into a lot of some people that have DUI problems, and so that's why they're walking. Also, there's a health facility down the street, a couple of miles down the street from me, and they sometimes think maybe you're from that, you know, you're homeless or whatever. I face that. Now, I don't really face a lot of flack from that, but you do get those funny looks, or someone might say something. Are you homeless? And you're like, no, I just choose to walk.
Well, John, I'm going to get some responses to your comments, but thank you so much for calling and telling us about walking in Old Shawnee.
Okay, well, thanks.
Rihanna, he mentioned a couple of things that I'd like to touch on with you. When you started walking, how did people respond to that? Did people seem to understand and embrace the decision, or did people view this as a weird thing you were doing?
I think people do assume that it's because of something else, like he was saying. And, you know, when I lost my car, I could have got another car, but I chose not to just because I knew that it would make my life less stressful. And I think that's something that you don't really understand unless you've made that decision as well.
What was it that was stressful about driving?
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, traffic and just dealing with other drivers and road rage and things like that.
I wonder what our city planning people were thinking when John was talking about his experience. Daniel?
Well, a couple of things. One is, you know, I think part of John's, the reactions that he's hearing, I was hoping those kinds of things were going away. I pay less attention to them, but I used to hear that sort of thing all the time 10, 20 years ago. There's a sort of presumption there must be something wrong with you if you're walking. The same thing happens with people who regularly use transit. Well, what's wrong? There must be something wrong. You know, there have been economic studies done, and housing professionals especially think a lot about what's referred to as the transportation cost burden. It typically costs between $7,000 and $10,000 per vehicle per year to maintain and own a car. That's including everything from maintenance to depreciation to fuel costs and that sort of thing. And it's a big drain on family budgets. There are parts of the metropolitan area where people spend more money annually on transportation than they do on housing. And people are usually pretty flabbergasted to stand back and look and recognize that. But it's part of the ingrained culture. And I think when you do something that seems a little out of the norm, the presumption sometimes is, well, there must be something wrong. You must have stepped out of sequence somehow. And I think what's so great about what you hear somebody like Rihanna saying is that there are people now that are making a deliberate choice not to own a car.
And Beau, what about you? What are you hearing in these remarks?
Well, I think it reflects the sort of auto-dominated society that we live in, and it's a difficult paradigm to shift. But we make an assumption in the walkability plan that there is a latent demand, that people will inherently walk if they are able or if we can provide the facilities for them to walk on. So it's not surprising to hear that someone has discovered that they like to walk, and it's not surprising to hear that people think it's odd.
If you are a pedestrian, call us up and tell us what's working for you and what's not. And if you're not a walker, what's stopping you? 816-235-2888. Central Standard will return right after a break. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard, and today we're talking about walking for transportation. My guests this morning are Beau Williams, with us from the city, urban design expert Daniel Serta, and Rihanna Weilert, a Kansas City walker who writes a blog called The Pedestrian Path. And we're going to be taking more of your calls in just a second. But Beau, before we move on, I want to ask you, what are the biggest challenges for the city in terms of increasing walkability and improving walkability?
Well, the first challenge for the city is probably just funding. We have an enormous need for infrastructure improvements and not enough resources to meet that need. So one of the important things that I mentioned earlier that the walkability plan does is to help us identify priority areas for infrastructure improvements related to pedestrian mobility.
I noticed in that plan that there's a neighborhood walkability assessment tool. Is the idea there that people can assess their own neighborhoods and submit those results to the city?
Yeah, that's the intent of the tool, is to help a neighborhood to decide whether or not they are quote-unquote walkable, and to identify those priority pedestrian routes that within their neighborhood that need improvement. It's a very clear methodology that anybody can use, and it does help you to identify that list of projects. And we have a process at the city, a quarter-cent sales tax. Our Public Improvement Advisory Committee takes requests every summer. And so neighborhoods will use this tool to identify those priority pedestrian improvements within their neighborhood and then submit the request, hopefully to get funding through PIAC.
And so the city created this walkability plan in 2003, you said?
That's right.
Have there been any projects that have taken place since then? I know funding is an issue, but anything resulting from it?
Yeah. Well, we've one of the big things we've done is to change our development codes to better incorporate pedestrian oriented development as the city grows. One of the recommendations in the pedestrian plan is that as we do traffic studies to evaluate impacts of development on streets for cars, that we also think about how those developments are accommodating pedestrian movements. And so that's now a development code requirement within our city development process. The other thing we've done, again, in our development code is to include new zoning tools that help to ensure that where we want to ensure pedestrian-oriented development, that we have tools that we can require that kind of development, requiring the buildings to be close to the street, connected to the sidewalk, with a certain level of window transparency on the first floor and things of that nature.
What about places where all of this development already exists, but somehow the walkability piece of it just isn't quite there? Are there neighborhoods that where it's not a matter of creating new development, but making the walkability around existing development better?
Sure, yeah. And we do neighborhood planning to try to enhance or even retrofit neighborhoods to be better walkable communities. We have that neighborhood assessment tool I mentioned earlier, and you can apply these development codes to historic areas that are traditionally more walkable and areas where you want to preserve or enhance that character. And we're working now actually on the Independence Avenue corridor and the Marlboro area to implement those kinds of development requirements to ensure a pedestrian-oriented environment.
So what will change around Independence Avenue?
Well, we'll see, we have to go through that process, but it's going to deal with requirements on development that reinforce that pedestrian mobility, that pedestrian orientation, and that help to ensure we have the kinds of uses in that development that pedestrians will want to walk to. As Daniel mentioned earlier, one of the key elements of a walkable community is having something to walk to.
So, Daniel, jump in for a second, and then we're going to get to our callers because we've got people who have things to say.
Sure. The other thing I wanted to mention is that there is an entire movement now within planning, urban planning and urban design called complete street design, and that entails the reconfiguration of streets to accommodate a whole range of users, including pedestrians, but also bicycling and transit. And so the reconfiguration of the street itself can also be a very critical element in promoting walkability in developed areas.
Let's hear from Justin in Westport. Hi, Justin.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I work in Westport, Midtown area, and walk every day. And my main concern, I think, like the aspect of pedestrianism that's reached a critical status is the mentality of drivers and just awareness. If there's not a stoplight, and you're in a crosswalk, it's like the 80s video game Frogger. You know, you'll have to stop in the middle of the road before you can continue crossing. And there are improvements infrastructure wise, like near like Main Street near the plaza, and Broadway near the community college there, where there have been stoplights installed. But I mean, I've lived in other cities where the pedestrian was respected more. So I don't know. I'd just like to see a more consciousness, awareness initiative to, you know, you're in the city and people, you know,
people might walk here.
Yeah.
Justin, yeah. Is there any particular crosswalk that is just notorious where you just want to deliver a message that there is a crosswalk in this spot and any drivers who might be listening will now know?
Yeah, I'd say like I think it's where it used to be Street Side Records, but now it's called Ale House. There's one right there. So it's actually better to go up to the stoplight and cross there. But, you know, I mean, when I moved away for a few years to a city that, Portland, Oregon, that really respects pedestrians, probably because they have to. You know, you come back and you're almost like, wow, someone who isn't from here, just visiting, if they don't know this, I mean, it could, you know, be really shocking that people just won't stop for you.
Let's get some response to this, because it seems like what can be done to, is there anything that the city can do to improve this, or is that just a mentality that is hard to change?
Well, there are things that can be that tend to encourage that mentality. I mean, a lot of our traffic engineering for an awfully long period of time has been oriented around convenience, mobility, speed, and even safety of drivers, to the detriment of pedestrians. And so, you know, if you don't have controlled intersections, if you don't have marked crosswalks, if you tend to have very wide lane widths that tend to encourage people to drive faster, drivers, you know, there are studies that show drivers are less attentive to the presence of pedestrians and probably a little more aggressive than they would be otherwise.
When you see a pedestrian only once in a blue moon, is that part of what contributes to this, though? Is there like a chicken and egg thing where you aren't habituated to looking out for this, perhaps?
Absolutely. The comments at the very opening of the show, where the interview that Matthew did, I made a couple of notes. I think it was interesting that the three things that walker mentioned, the quality of the neighborhood environment, the lack of marked crosswalks, and the scale of number of traffic lanes and that sort of thing, those are all the kinds of factors that discourage people from walking, frankly. And if people are you know, discouraged from walking, there are going to be fewer of them out there, and drivers are going to be less attentive.
We've got a full switchboard, so I'm going to jump now over to Sharon in Kansas City on the Plaza. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I wanted to just comment on the downtown's greater area plan, redevelopment plan, and why it is allowing RFPs to go out to developers who bring in residential building plans that include enormous amounts of parking. And at that point, they're usually ground level, so that you get this reinforcement of cars being dominant in our city streets. This is happening repeatedly. The plans are coming forward to the DNC here in the city, and there is concern about the allowing this to be subsidized, even the parking for these structures.
So I'm going to get some responses to Sharon. Bo, it seems like you're the best suited to respond to this.
Sure. And we are taking the Greater Downtown Area Plan and implementing those land use and development recommendations now. So we're starting on the downtown loop area. In fact, we just went to the City Plan Commission recently to get a rezoning of the downtown loop approved that will incorporate many of these pedestrian-oriented development ideas and standards. And we will expand that those zoning requirements to the other greater downtown area neighborhoods soon, particularly along the new streetcar line as well. So I guess to the extent that we have discretionary review, we are attempting to implement these pedestrian guidelines as development occurs, and we are actively changing development requirements to ensure that those things happen.
Let's hear from Marley in Butler, Missouri. Hi, Marley.
Hi, I live in a small town. It's 4,200 people, and I'm moving next month to the Plaza. And I've enjoyed my small town because I can walk into the square where the courthouse majestically is on the square. And there used to be a grocery store there, and I had a dog, and we would walk often, and most mornings we would walk to the grocery store and buy, you know, one or two items. Moving to the Plaza, I'm eager for all of access to walking many places, but I don't understand, with the density of the Plaza neighborhoods, why there isn't a grocery store. There had been, because I used to shop at it. But why isn't there a grocery store on the Plaza? So we can walk to that.
Okay, so that's an interesting thing. The idea of a neighborhood and walkability and destinations, what about, we think of destinations as things that are like the exciting places to go, but practical needs, just the idea of walkability being something that on your walking path, you can take care of all those things you need to do as a person who exists with a complete life. Rihanna, as a walker, talk to us about this.
Yeah, actually, I'm really guilty of, you know, yesterday I was going to a meeting, walking to a meeting near Crown Center, and I stopped in at the shoe store because I was thinking, oh, I need some better walking shoes. And you know, to the point of the plaza having like more touristy shops, the Costantino's that's downtown is always packed with visitors. So I think that something like a grocery store could serve both purposes in that way.
Daniel, what about this idea of walkability being, we think of it as a really urban feature, but Marley just talked about it as a small town way of life. Is this a way that the small town and the big city are kind of connected?
Oh, absolutely. The work my firm does, we actually do small town and neighborhood business district studies. And it's interesting because the scale of the buildings and the size of the streets and the kinds of amenities and features you need, they're really the same. It's really what it comes down to. Bo mentioned before the Independence Avenue and Marlborough study that we're getting ready to start on. One of the things really interesting to me about Marlborough is that's an area that was essentially suburban when it was developed, but there's a very walkable, very dense, very urban commercial area there. It's not big. It's just a couple of blocks. But you find those kinds of features throughout a lot of older neighborhoods, and you certainly find them in small towns. And when it comes down to it, the conversations are the same in both places in terms of planning interventions, transportation investments that are being made now, infrastructure changes that are being made. You're widening sidewalks, you're installing control crosswalks, and you're trying to promote a density of businesses and activities there to encourage people to walk.
Bo, is there a place right now where you think this is a great model for the city, like a part of the city that where we can take what's working there and maybe translate it to other places?
Well, I live in Brookside, so I'll say Brookside is maybe one of those areas. The Country Club Plaza, as Daniel mentioned, is maybe another one of those areas.
So what do we learn from Brookside?
Well, you have a density of businesses, as Daniel just alluded to, and you have the kinds of businesses, as our caller mentioned, that people need and want to walk to daily. And you have a high level of permeability between the business area and the surrounding neighborhoods.
So the residential parts.
So you have the residential, a fairly dense single family and multifamily residential area, well connected to in pedestrian human scale blocks nearby.
Bo Williams from the city's Planning and Development Office, thanks so much for being a part of this conversation. And Daniel Serta, a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
And Rihanna Weilert. We'll keep reading your dispatches from the pedestrian path.
Thanks.